pals of mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. You know those questions people ask when they want a deep and meaningful conversation? Like, which would you choose? True love with a guarantee of a broken heart, or never loved at all? Or, what's the difference between telling a lie and keeping a secret? Cheryl Labettis's high school English teacher asked the class, after reading Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, what are you willing to die for? Later, at age 19, she found herself in the South, a white California teenager canvassing a small community in Berkeley County, South Carolina, to register black voters. The year was 1965, and Martin Luther King Jr. had specifically requested white people to register black people to vote. She wrote about her experiences in her book, You Came Here to Die, Didn't You? A question asked of her by a young black man.
So you started at what college?
Cal Berkeley.
And why Cal Berkeley? Is that just the one that was down the street from where you grew up? Or?
My freshman year, I was in the California CSF, California Federation of whatever. Because I was part of that group, they took us to colleges across, well, not across the state, but the northern part of the state. So we went to Stanford, we went to Davis, we went to UOP, we went to Berkeley, among others. And I walked on campus and went, that's it. This is where I want to be. This atmosphere of the place was such that and the overall ambience, the educational part just oozing out of the buildings captured me. Little did I know what else there was going to be. So I fell in love with the campus when I was a freshman, and asked myself, what do I have to do in order to be able to go to school here? And that's how I planned my high school education. Had to have good grades and take the certain classes, but there was also like so many extracurricular activities. You had to be president of so many clubs. You had to serve on so many committees. And I went to a small school, so even finding all those things. But I spent that 3.5 years figuring out how you got into Berkeley.
And how did you fund it?
My dad and mom.
So you were lucky that your parents could help you out.
My mom went to work. She had been a stay-at-home mom, but there was no way they were going to pay for Berkeley, even though it was extraordinarily cheap compared to what's going on now. But they were disappointed I didn't want to go to UCLA, because that's where my dad wanted me. No, I was the first kid in my family to ever go to college, on either side, all the way back.
Why UCLA then?
They were from Southern California, and for some reason they liked UCLA, perhaps because they hated USC. And they hated USC because it was a school for people with money, they thought. It was a school for people with money. And so they were bad, and UCLA was good.
It's funny because that rivalry still exists.
I know.
Hatfields and McCoys.
Yes, yes. Like Berkeley and Stanford.
Now, did you have siblings?
I had a brother that was 6 years younger.
So that's quite a distance then,
yes.
As far as paying attention to what you were doing, what choices you were making at
yes.
the time.
Yes.
Now, did you have friends that also decided to pursue college as well? Or?
Most of my good friends went to college. Actually, there was a fellow from my class who went to Berkeley, and after a year, he decided that it was too cold and calculating, and therefore, he quit. Most of my friends went to Davis or Sac State.
Agriculture, or what was their name?
One of them is a photographer, and she went to Davis. Susan went to Davis. She was into languages. She spent a lot of time in France, and so she went to Davis. She actually wanted them to spend, when she graduated and walked across the stage, she wanted them to play the French national anthem. They didn't do it.
Oy.
Oy. Comment on my mother, though, who did go back to work in order to be able to put me through school. She graduated from high school a week before I did. She fell in love with my dad. They were in Great Falls, Montana. She fell in love with my dad. She would not marry him until she was 18, but she didn't mind dropping out of school halfway through her, or all the way through her junior year. So She didn't have a high school education. She went to night school finally and graduated a week before us.
Good for mom.
I think so too. It was like, would you be willing to graduate across the stage? No. No, really, if you could. She wouldn't have been allowed to. But would that have been cool or what?
That's a photo opportunity.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And what was your dad during this time?
My dad was a pilot. That's where they met at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls. He was involved in a war.
Did he ever talk about it?
Yeah, he did. And I think part of the reason that he was so willing to was that he flew a C-47, a Goonie Bird, and most of his experiences, since he was flying cargo, he didn't have some of the horrid experiences. I'm sure he had some. But he told jokes a lot. He was in Venice? I can't remember. Anyway, it was an Italian city, and they were on their own time, and Humphrey Bogart was there with his wife, his first wife, and apparently they loved to fight. He tells the story of this sweeping staircase coming down from the other stories, and here are Bogart and his wife throwing things at each other back and forth across, up and down the stairway. Talked about when he was flying out of North Africa at some place, and he'd had too much to drink the night before. He needed to sober up. He pulled open the window. He stuck his head out in the middle of an ice storm and just peeled all the skin off. So we got those kinds of stories, the funny ones.
Not so funny to Bogie.
Ah, I don't know. Maybe he liked hitting her with the things he was throwing.
No, I meant the ice hitting his face.
Oh,
that must have been painful.
Not nearly. Yeah. Yeah. And my mom did tell stories. I mean, she was... The rare story from my mom, I remember she was so upset about, not that she was so upset about the Depression, she had absolutely no clue. Her grandfather died 2 weeks before the crash and left her mother with six kids and one, she was pregnant with one. She'd never worked. And so with him gone, they suddenly ended up with no income. And my mom could remember taking the pail and walking down to, it wasn't a church, but walking down to wherever the soup lines were and getting the pail full of soup and the loaf of bread and then coming back and how embarrassed she was. Because at that time, she was probably about 8 when she was doing that. And for however long it lasted, so. She didn't have experiences that she wanted to share.
That gives you a little bit of insight firsthand on pride, humility, and struggling.
Why she kept the house the way she did. She was dysfunctionally clean. And why she was my biggest supporter when I finally decided that I was going to... She in particular, although he didn't disagree, but she taught us that if you believe something, you really have to act on it. So, and she kept doing that. And so that became part of who we both were. My brother was too. And she was the one that was into doing things because they're right. She also, though, not totally doing your own thing, because she was the one who wouldn't let everything have to look perfect, including us. When I was a teenager, I had a horse, and so I spent most of my time away from home riding my horse. But if I came home and she said, I'm going to town, and I didn't do anything, no makeup, no nothing. I'm riding my horse. Who needs that stuff? And when I would come home and she'd say, we're going to town, which was a big deal. We lived in Shingle Springs. Town was Placerville. It was 10 miles away. And we didn't go very often, once a week for food. And so, do you want to go to town? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd love to go to town. Good. Put on your makeup. No makeup? No town.
Appearances.
The house. The kids.
Reflection on her as well.
Absolutely.
Still. Early experiences never quite leave.
Nope.
So let's talk about your initial days in college. Was it overwhelming at all, did you feel, coming from a small area?
Absolutely. My high school was 800. It had been a little bit larger. I went to El Dorado High School for 3 years, and then they moved us to Ponderosa. There were only 800 kids, so it was very small, which is why you could have all the classes on a two-sided piece of legal paper. It was small. It was a new school, and they had to come up with a government. They had to write a constitution. They had to do all that new school stuff, pick the school colors, do all that. Well, I did get involved in that. The administration, I was part of a little group of people who thought that the Constitution definitely was too schoolish, had too few really serious ideas, allowed it too much fluff. I mean, after all, this is a Constitution. It should be more serious. Under my senior picture, they wrote that, I didn't say this, but they wrote that I had said, I'm off to solve the problems of the world. And they were right. So I think I was a real pain in the butt for a lot of folks. When I read my yearbooks now, freshman year, I was just so silly like everybody else. Senior year, I'm off to solve the problems of the world. And a whole lot of things, like comments that were pretty much that you're taking life too seriously.
Well, your awareness is such that you realize that there's something.
I had a few terrific teachers, but one in particular, and the book's dedicated to him. He hammered us about taking responsibility for what was going on in the world. And whereas our history teachers would talk about what was going on, he was hammering us. And like one class that he taught was called Senior English, and we had to read 50 books during the year. This was the list of books you should read before you go to college because they're going to assume you've read these things kind of list. There were books from different countries. There were plays. There were essays. There were long books like War and Peace. There were short books. There were...
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
He was extraordinary.
To expose kids to that, that's fabulous.
And the only assignment was to write in your journal. Fridays, we had to talk about the books we were reading in case somebody else might want to read them. And then we had to write in our journal, and we were supposed to write things like quotes from the book. What caught your eye, and what did you think about that? So give me the quote, and then tell me why it's important to you kind of stuff. Or we had to say, well, what would we have done differently? I mean, just a lot of really nice prompts.
As opposed to, what did Moby Dick really represent?
Thank you. It was all about, you're reading the book, but this is all about you and what you think while you're reading the book.
My social studies teacher, I think it was junior year in high school, and this is during Watergate, and he would tell us every Friday, I want you to read the newspaper. On Sunday, and we're going to discuss it on Monday. And every Monday, nobody had read the paper, or very few of us had read the paper, because we were teenagers.
Yeah.
And one day, he just lost it. Because he went on about Watergate. This is the president of our country. He was livid.
Yes!
And I'd never seen a teacher lose it like that. And that's what made an impression on me. Oh, there's something I'm supposed to be paying attention to. It's not just something to memorize for a test.
Exactly.
And so I love it when I find teachers such as yourself who really become passionate, and that teacher that you're speaking of, because that's what makes impression on the students.
Exactly.
Because you're not bored with your job, you're actually interested in it.
You think they make a difference.
So they pick up on your interest, your enthusiasm. It's infectious. I can't help but pay attention.
When we studied, it was our junior year, I had him 3 years. Two, I know. Our junior year, we read On Civil Disobedience by Thoreau. And so he closes the book as we finished reading it. He looks at us and says, what are you willing to die for? Most everybody thought it was rhetorical. And I asked them today, because we did just have our 50th class reunion, and I asked them today, do you remember that? Yeah, but it was just Mr. Harvey doing what he does. And for me, it was like, that was an assignment. What was I willing to die for? And so it took me a year and a half, 2 years to figure it out. But that was between reading the books and knowing that what I thought was important from him and having him say, look, you're a participant in this system because it's democracy. You have to get involved. You can't just go to sock hops and football games, most of which I didn't go to anyway. But it's not about that. It's about becoming a independent and well-read voter.
And again, teenagers really voting is not in their realm of awareness, not really until I think it was MTV. Which was, get the vote out or whatever that was called. It didn't enter their peripheral of awareness.
Still
not. It was adults, like nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
The teenagers of today has come full circle with the radicals, as they were known back in the 60s, late 60s, of making things, of changing things, of being angry, like, you screwed this planet up for us, now we've got to fix it, we've got to clean it up, because you're not going to do anything about it.
Yes, yes.
So when you arrived, you were in college in 1965, and you must have felt, well, as you said, you were pulled to that particular campus. There's just something about it. You could feel energy there of some sort.
Yeah, exactly.
There was movement. There was
yes.
activity.
Yes.
There was stimulation.
Yes. And I had no clue. I knew that it was a great academic institution. At that time, it was one of the 10 best in the grad school anyway, one of the 10 best in the country. So I knew that it was academic, but I didn't know that it was the first year of the FSM, the free speech movement. Mario Savio and some of the other people that led that movement and all of the political upheaval at Cal that year had been civil rights workers. They had been in SNCC and they had worked in Mississippi. And so they took changing the world. They were willing to die for it. They'd already shown that in Mississippi. So now here they are on Sproul Hall standing on the steps saying, we have activities for you to do. And of course, the university and the community responded with police and sheriffs and a whole list of stuff. And I was just like, what is going on? And I can remember one day walking from the dorm, and I was walking right past the women's gym. Right next to the women's gym, there was a garage, and it was the size of 4 tennis courts. Because the tennis courts were on top, and then underneath was the garage. And I'm walking by, and it's full of police, sheriffs, police from the local community, people they'd brought in from someplace else, I don't know. But it was packed, and I was absolutely stunned. What am I doing here? I'm sitting in Spanish class. I get tear cast. So I'm watching all of this going, this is really strange, but really exciting. I like the idea of forcing change, but I'm not going to play. These are big guys. I'm just watching from afar thinking, does this tie in with what are you willing to die for? I mean, I was asking myself, does this have something to do with what Bruce had said, and should I be doing this? Nah, this doesn't.
It's a mystery you're trying to solve, and
it is.
You're a part in it.
That's right. That's right.
What hasn't been told to you?
What hasn't been told to me?
No, I mean, it's one of those moments where you're thinking, what am I missing?
Exactly.
What has not been told to me? What has not been shared with me? So I can get a clearer picture, more
exactly.
details.
Exactly.
So how did the assisting the registration of black voters come into play? Was that during your freshman year?
Yes. Yes. Well, you have the question, what are you willing to die for? And as I'm walking by the young communist table, the young socialist table, the young ROTC and all these things, and it was in my mind, is this something I should be doing? And the summer of 1964, which is before I went to Cal, that was Freedom Summer. And there were 1,000 students that went from the north down, white students mostly, that went down to the south to Mississippi to register voters. 3 of them, Schwerner, Goodman and Cheney, were abducted and murdered by the Klan. And we knew they'd been abducted, or we knew they were gone. They had been arrested for speeding. They had gone to jail. They were let out of jail in the middle of the night. On their way out of town, the Klan picked them up and got involved with them. Somehow, they stopped them anyway. They were murdered. Then the Klan took the car and put it in the swamp, but they didn't. But nobody knew what had happened to the bodies. They found the car because the president had them actually drag the swamps expecting to find these 3 guys. They didn't find those 3 guys. They found a lot of black men who had disappeared over time that nobody knew what had happened with them. So now people at least knew that it was 45 days, I think, and they finally found him in an earthen dam. That was pretty horrid, and I remember thinking, oh my God, this can't happen in the United States. March of 65 was Selma, and I'm watching, I'm 18 now, so My folks can't stop me. So I'm watching, and I was so horrified. I mean, I've been horrified about what was going on in South Africa, but I had no clue that it was here, too, except for what I've been seeing a little couple of years, going through a couple of years. So my U.S. History TA came in and said, we are not having class today, and I'm not quite sure when we'll have class again. I'm going to Selma. And I don't know when I'll be back. Well, if John Nelson can go to Selma, why can't I? And then it was like, Sherry, this was March. You have 2 months, and you will have finished your freshman year. Your parents have really extended themselves to give you this opportunity. And I met a lot of Black kids who had that same experience. So you can't go now. And then a month later, Martin Luther King came out and said, please, we need more workers to come to the South. The Voter Rights Act is supposed to pass in June. We want boots on the ground to get into those communities and get those Black people registered to vote. It didn't pass until August. But we did the same thing anyway. We just didn't have the federal government supporting it. So that's what got me to go. I mean, I was like, okay, sign me up. And we had a couple of classes. I don't remember them very clearly. They were at Sproul, or at, right now I can't remember where. They were put on by the American Friends Service Committee. And I wasn't involved in it that I remember, but there was a drive to get money from people who were involved in the university because they had to be able to support our project. We were told that we should bring $50 to get to Atlanta, which is where our training began, our real training began, and $10 a week for the time we were going to be there. They never said anything about money to come home. We individually had to come up with money, but then the project overall had to come up with so much money in order to get SELC to pay attention to them.
And how do you train? It seems like such an inane event, just registering people. Exactly. So what was their perspective of appropriate, quote-unquote, training?
It was a week long. It started at 8 o'clock in the morning and went to midnight. It was at Morris Brown, which is a Black college in Atlanta. Have the schedule. It was like going to college. We had people from the AFL-CIO discussing unions, how to start unions, how to respond to unions, how there are going to be similarities in organizing your communities with unions. And so there was training on unions. There was training on what do you do if you get busted? Who do you call? What do you not do? You know, keep your mouth shut. That kind of what do you not do? We had lessons on how to file claims against registrars if they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, because although the act hadn't passed yet, according to the Voter Rights Act, if you had a registrar who gave you a hard time, then they would send down a federal one. So it was like literally kicking out the local folks. There was a lot of time spent on nonviolence. Martin Luther King spoke not just on nonviolence, but a lot of things. We had a chance to meet him and talk with him. So there was the philosophy of nonviolence. And why you should be nonviolent, it's like, well, I wasn't then. There was the religious nonviolence, since most of this project was carried by ministers like King and Abernathy and Andy Young. They were all ministers. And so they're coming at it from, well, this is what Christ would do. He'd turn the other cheek. They said, though, wait, that's not going to get all of you. So look at it this way. Think of it from the point of view of not making things worse. For instance, if you're walking down the street and somebody walks towards you and they hit you and you hit them back, you've become the aggressor. It's your fault you got hit. Huh? But this is the South. The other thing is we had come 3,000 miles to have him hit us. So we were sort of perpetrators, but And the idea of a domino thing, if you're walking down the street and you have a group with you and somebody comes up and with another group and he hits you and you hit him, you're going to have a riot. I mean, you're going to have a fight. Your friends are going to protect you. His friends are looking for an excuse. And so that's one reason not to do it. You're protecting yourself and the people you're with. Just be nonviolent. If you're typical, you're not going to get hurt very badly. So the third reason to be nonviolent is strategy. If there is a camera, if there is a reporter where you are when you're attacked, you have to be nonviolent. I don't think they saw it as a tactic, but I do now. What we want is to show a lot of people being beaten because they believe in the black right to vote. So if you're in a position to continue to encourage that thought that people are beaten for the right for blacks to vote, then you can't fight back. But if you're walking down a road, a dirt road out in the country, and a pickup truck full of white men starts following you, you have to make a choice. The first one is run like hell, right? But are you religious enough that you're going to just let them do whatever they're going to do? There's nobody there to take pictures, and you're not trying to keep other people from getting involved. You don't care if you're the aggressor. You just want to get rid of them. And we did almost a whole day of nonviolent behavior. What happens if you get hit? What happens if you get spit on? What happens if you get pushed? And we would do exercises where one person stands in the middle and there's five or six people around them. And if you're on the outside, your job is to get me to fight. I'm in the middle. And so somebody might just push me. Somebody might spit on me. Somebody might hit me. But it was whatever you could think of to make her fight, do it. We got kind of knocked around. But the idea was, if somebody can't be nonviolent because they can be, then we have things they can do. They can work in an office. They can work at writing articles. There's all kinds of things you can do. But in terms of being on the front line where you might be accosted, can't do that because you would ruin our average, so to speak. Lots of freedom songs every day. And at night before we went to bed, there were a lot of other things that I don't remember. But at night before we went to bed, we'd have a movie. And one of the movies was, it really made a difference for me. And it wasn't A Raisin in the Sun, although we did see A Raisin in the Sun.
I was thinking that in Lilies in the Field.
Yeah, it wasn't that either. It was...
Call me Mr. Tibbs.
Well, anyway. And, oh, it was about... Ivan Dixon was in it. No Man. We had the movies. They planned them carefully. And then during the whole week, they're talking about where you might go. And, of course, everybody knows about Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama because that's where things were really hot. I remember thinking I wanted to go to either Mississippi or Alabama. And so I was not disappointed when I found out that a lot of our group, we thought, were going to go to Mobile, Alabama. And you didn't know up until the last day. And then that Sunday, they said, okay, this group is going here, this group is going here, this group is going here. So for a whole week, you've wondered what wondrous place they were going to send you so you could write that How I Spent My Summer Vacation. And I was sent to, along with three other people from Berkeley, I was sent to Charleston. That was the training. It was a week, and I can remember thinking, you know, I had classes at Cal that were easier than this.
Where did the actual voter registration take place that you were...
I don't even know in Charleston, because we went out and talked to people and tried to get their names.
So you were on the streets just trying to...
We were on the streets. Charleston was horrid. My folks were lower middle class, but they were moving up. But I hadn't seen poverty. I mean, the kid across the street was poor because he didn't have clothes and he would never have passed muster with my mother. But there were a lot of people we saw who could not read and write. So they couldn't write their names. And at that time, you had to be able to write your name. And one lady was all willing to go register because that's really cool. I'll go if you think I should. What does it mean to register? What does it mean to vote? She had no clue. And another lady, I asked her to spell her name, bad thing to do, and she just read off a list of letters. So she couldn't. And that was depressing. But I think the worst thing I saw the whole summer was in Charleston. Carol and I were walking, or canvassing, and something smelled. And it smelled like something had died, like somebody hit a dog or something. And it got worse and it got worse. We were getting closer to it. And she finally said, I ain't going. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to go work over here. I had said that I would do it. So I went ahead and finally found this woman. She was in this little cell of a room. It was probably only about this big from where you are over. And there were no windows, and the door was propped open, and it was probably 90 degrees and 90% humidity. And it was propped open with a rock, and she's laying in bed. And I said her name. I said, is that you? Because we had a list. And she said that it was. And then my eyes had by then just kind of cleared, and so I could see in the dark, and I noticed these flies, and they were just flying around in a circle. And it was kind of like watching an inverse tornado, and they were landing on her leg. And her leg was a balloon. And then part of the smell was the sheets weren't clean. She'd crapped on them. And part of it was the infection. And part of it was the rot. I looked at her leg, and it looked like a black scab. It wasn't. It was the flies that were flying around and had landed in and on her leg and each other. That made me go home or go back to the church and say, maybe this isn't, maybe I can't do this. This is not voter registration. This is, and everybody had a story. Nobody had found somebody who was obviously dying. Nobody had had that experience. But everybody's saying, you want us to register voters. We can't register voters if they can't read and write. We can't register voters if they're dying. We can't register voters and the guy just listens to us saying, the director just listens to us saying why we can't. And then he said, why do you think you're here? If you don't get people to register, nobody's going to take care of these folks. Nobody cares about them. Nobody who has power cares about them. We kind of backed off and decided that we would hang out a little bit longer. But then there were politics. The NAACP and SCLC both had groups working together in Charleston. SCLC wanted us registering voters. The NAACP wanted us to get arrested. Can't register voters if you're arrested. Yes, but if we want to do court cases, you gotta get arrested. And while they're trying to figure it out, we spend 3 days sitting in a church waiting for assignments. And there was this lady in Pineville, South Carolina. Her name was Martha Prelo Simmons. When she had heard about our program was called SCOPE, Southern Community Organization and Political Education. She had heard that SCLC was having the SCOPE project, so she got a hold of SCLC and said, I want 30 workers. She was in Berkeley County, one of the largest counties in the state, and she said, I want 30 workers, and she went out and bought stuff. So they said, okay. She goes out and she buys stuff so that she can house 30 workers. Nobody came, but she heard there were four. There were actually more than four, but there were nine of us. She heard there were nine SCOPE workers in Charleston. So she put on her hat and she went to town. And the next day, four of us ended up in Pineville. And that's where I spent my summer. That was where I did most of my voter registration. And in answer to your question of where did they register, they registered at the town hall in Monk's Corner, which is about 50 miles from where we were. Now, about 25, 30 miles from where we were. Which brings up the idea of how do you get people from Pineville to Monk's Corner? And we did it with buses. But, I mean, people didn't go to Monk's Corner very often at all because people didn't have cars. They had buckboards They had wagons and mules. We had cars. We paid $800 for a used car so that we could do what we had to do. And sometimes we carried them, but buses, church buses.
And 50 years later, we're back in Charleston. And
oh, yeah, exactly. And one of the things that I've been doing is that we are the SCOPE group, all 400 of them, they're having a reunion in October. And so we are finding all these people, 400 people who have the Southern Christian Leadership Converse did not keep elegant records. And people slid. I mean, somebody might be on their way through and work with us. One person I know for sure from Mobile on his way home in New York, he came and he worked with us for a week and then he disappeared. So he never appeared on our list, but he worked with us. So it was just this very fluid, very uncomfortable way of living for somebody who had always had due dates, and this is what you're supposed to do, this is when you're supposed to do it. And I mean, we went to Berkeley, for God's sake, so we knew how to take classes, drop classes, go through a lot of rigmarole and stuff. We didn't know how to just sit and wait for something to happen, like trying to start a youth group, because we couldn't do it without a youth group. There are four of us, four white people stuck in the middle of an area of the county that was 99% black. And now we're going to talk them into registering to vote, even though they could die doing it. We're going to convince them that we really know what's good for them. When I think of the audacity now, but without it, we never would have gotten there. We didn't even speak the same language. We spoke Collegese. They had Southern accents, but then they also were near the islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. The Gullah people live there, Gullahs or Geechies. Their language is supposed to be the closest to an African language left in the country. So not only was it Southern when we were Northern, but it was also with this real Geechee twist to it that made it really hard to understand. So here we are trying to convince this person to register to vote. He speaks Geechee, we speak Collegese. Now how are we going to convince him that it's safe to get involved with us? And that was what the summer was about. It wasn't registering voters. Andrew Young said, what you do in terms of voting is important, but what you do in terms of sharing culture is the real reason you're going.
So how was the adjustment when you returned home?
Home? Like California?
Yes.
When I was at my parents' in Shingle Springs, there was no problem. It was easy. We lived out in the country, so we didn't see a lot of folks. But when I was at Berkeley, I went to San Francisco State the summer after I came home. And oh, another piece before that. At the end of the summer, kid dared me. His name was Kenny Washington, and he said, you keep trying to talk us into going to white schools. Have you ever been to a black school? Of course not. Why? Well, because they aren't as good as white schools. How do you know that? I read. You go to a black school, and I will go to a white school. I said, you get me an application, I will fill it out. And if I'm accepted, I'll go. We're out in the middle of nowhere. There isn't a college for 50 miles. And we're leaving in 3 days. It wasn't that I was thinking that. I was legit when I said it. He showed up the next day with an application to Allen University, which is an African Methodist Episcopal College in Columbia, South Carolina. So I fill out this application. I send it off. 3 days later, I come home. 2 weeks later, I call because I miss everybody. There's a letter here for you from Allen University. Cool. Open it. What does it say? See, now here's where you're going to find out that they discriminate against white people. You are accepted to come to Allen University. Please report on, and they give the day. My mother, who thought that you should do what you believe in, took me down to Berkeley, got my money back because we'd already paid my fees, got my money back, brought me home. My dad said, I'll never speak to you again if you go this time. And I'm thinking, no problem, my dad can't keep his mouth shut. So I really wasn't too worried about that. So I fly into Columbia, South Carolina. I'm met at the airport by a black man. This is not what you're supposed to do. I knew better. He drives me to Allen University. He opens the back of the car, the trunk. He takes out my suitcase. He sets it on the sidewalk and says, I hope this goes real well for you. Bye. And leaves. I was the only white student on campus. There was only one other white person on campus. From June to, so I was 6-7 months in South Carolina. And I really was not particularly fond of white people. I mean, they had burned our church. They had set fire to the school. They had beaten people up. Can't trust white folks. I couldn't go off campus with any of my friends because they were black. So if I wanted to get away and just, I could do that, but I had to go alone. So when I came home and I went to San Francisco State and then to back to Cal, I didn't want to be around white people. So basically I moved into the ghetto. And so I was a Cal 66 to 69. Yeah, that's when I got my teaching credential in 69, graduated in 68. So I lived off campus and I lived on the other side of the tracks where I was perfectly comfortable.
Now, as a teacher, what ages did you teach?
I taught junior seniors most of the time. Taught a lot of different things. I taught 35 years.
What subjects?
Government and U.S. history.
Really?
Well, you see,
I
gave up that law thing in exchange for I had an agenda. Some people continued to do community organization, which is what we were doing. Some people became lawyers and did civil rights stuff. I figured, gimme kids. Let me talk to them about tolerance and love and differences and joys in getting involved. And I ended up here in Roseville. And so, although there weren't a lot of black kids where I taught, because I taught at Success and Adelante, which were continuation schools. Most of the kids that were there were Hispanic, which is a whole new dynamic for me. So that's what I taught.
So what was the impetus and or catalyst for your your putting your memories down and speaking to others that were there during that time?
One of them was the kids I was seeing. And the perfect example was a kid named Jason. At Adelante, kids could take, they took six-week classes. Being continuation school kids, they couldn't always stand a teacher more than 6 weeks. And as a teacher, we definitely couldn't always stand them more than 6 weeks. So this kid I was very fond of, and he flunked my class and flunked my class and flunked my class with U.S. history. Why? And, well, Jason, you've got to register and vote. You've got to this, you've got to do that. No, I don't really care about this. Well, the next year he had government from another teacher, and he came in one day and he said, why is it that Miss Jacobson thinks voting is so important? I wanted to hit him upside the head. I mean, I had PowerPoints, I had pictures, I had almost everything I've got now, I had then. And it was like, you haven't heard me, you don't hurt her. Hear her. And so I thought, textbooks do not teach the civil rights movement. So I was thinking, maybe, and then my personal treat out of all of this, although the civil rights work was wonderful, is that I met a lady named Sarah Butler. And she'd already registered to vote, but she wanted me to get her husband to register. That was a waste of time and energy. But we connected, and so if I was scared, and I was a lot, if I was missing my folks, I would go out and see Miss Sarah. And she lived for about 12 more years after that. And I was calling her. I was writing to her. She had a phone, which was unusual, and sending money. And I did that with some other people too, but Sarah was special. And on her deathbed, she said to her daughter, Lottie, Sherry is a good one, meaning white person. And you should not let her go. You are the lucky one of my family. And she said, she is your sister. Okay, Sarah says it, that makes it so. And so Lottie and I did as much as we could do to be sisters from afar. And then in 2000, I was married before, but in 2000, Joe and I went down to meet my family because Lottie had made sure that I knew about every birth, every marriage, everything. She sent me a quilt that was made out of wedding dresses and prom dresses and everything from the family.
Lovely.
So we go down in 2000. He hasn't had a whole lot of black friends either. He's from Kewaunee, the hog capital of the world in Illinois. And this is the first time I'd ever been all together with all of them. There probably were 50 people there. And so Joe, clever and really good with people. So he has a video camera. And he says, he goes up to each person. He says, I have a question for you. What's your name and how are you related to Lottie? So he managed to get everybody on film so we could see them with their voices and everything else. Her youngest son, Albert, really got caught up in everything because he came up and he said, Joe said, well, who are you? And he said, I'm Albert. I'm Lottie's son. And you're my Uncle Joe. And you were born in the daytime and I was born at night.
Oh.
So we have this all on video. And in 2005, 5 years later, I'm talking to a friend and I'm thinking of writing a book about my dad. And she was so gracious and helped me so much. I said, I took this video and showed it to her and said, this is my family that I've been talking about. And I get done and she said, there's your book. And bing, she was right. Now, what we originally thought it would be was kind of what it was in the past and what it is in the present, mixing them. But it just didn't work. So it ended up being how I spent my summer vacation more than anything else. She edited the whole thing. Her husband edited the whole thing. My husband edited the whole thing. And then we got I was ready to get a paid editor. And we did, which was a wonderful experience. I love being edited. Yeah, I like that whole process of trying to figure out how to do what it is they're asking. That's why if I hadn't shown it to Eleanor, shown that video to Eleanor, and now I can do this whole festival because now I have the early family there and I have Lottie's 90th birthday video. And as soon as it arrives, she died in April. And as soon as it arrives, I will have, they did her funeral. But for her 90th birthday, was very cool. We go in, we're the only white people there. Actually, there were two, I think, out of 250. And so we go in and we sit at this table, right? And there was a raised area and then there was a long table on it. And that was for her and her brothers and sisters. Well, brothers and their wives. There were no sisters at that time. So we sit as close as we can get to the stage and somebody comes up and says, you can't sit here. Come on. Gets us up, takes us up and puts us on the stage. I'm her sister.
Well, soul sister, there's no skin color with souls.
That's it. I'm not sure if I went to South Carolina to register voters or if I went to South Carolina
to complete your family.
Yeah. And I'm Aunt Sherry he's Uncle Joe to over 100 people. And since my parents and my brother are gone, since 2000, I went down every year, every 2 years. It was like, okay, she's not living forever, and we're running out of time. So I would go down and just sit and do whatever it was she was doing.
So you didn't come here to die. You came here to share the stories.
Yes.
And to preserve family legacies.
And you are so right. One of the things is that these people didn't have money. They didn't have cameras. So that videotape he took. Now, by the time she was 90, so 10 years, so was it 12 years later, they did have videotape and all that, and they're sending me stuff. But there was only 3 pictures of Sarah ever. I had them. And one was with my father because my parents wanted to meet Sarah. They wanted to see where I had been. So about 3 years later, they took a trip across the country and they went to Pineville. So I got a picture of my dad with Sarah, and it's very cool. There weren't many pictures of Lottie. There was one gentleman, I got a thing from a guy who said, his name's Simmons, and he said, my father was George Simmons' brother, and George Simmons is the house I lived in. And he said, I got the book on Kindle. And I wrote back and said, that's too bad because there's no pictures. And I sent him 2 pictures of his uncle. And they were the only pictures anybody in the family had. So more than you know. And one person said, well, you're a griot. You're here to tell our stories. Yeah, I am. Continuing.
And I'm sure that you've set a grand example for them to continue what you started. So on their behalf, thank you for planting the seed.
Thank you.
In her book, she writes a footnote about Pineville, the community she was sent to for canvassing of black voters. It reads, Pineville must have been a small place. According to a woman at the Information Resources and Dissemination Branch of the U.S. Census Bureau, I have been unable to locate Pineville in any of our census years. U.S. Census Bureau, 2010. Yeah. Do something different. Volunteer at a senior center.